Bob's Red Mill, believes in baking, breakfast, and the pursuit of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it is a gorgeous spring weekend here in Brooklyn. We're at Heritage Radio Network's home at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. And I, for one, am really excited because my CSA is going to start this week. And I know a lot of other people are just starting their CSAs or going to the farmer's market and finding it filled with color for like the first time this year so far, at least in the Northeast here. We're not that blessed with anything too colorful during the winter. So it's a really great time to cook. But I find that a lot of people get confused sometimes of what to do with, you know, things that they're unfamiliar with in their CSA, or they come across something that looks really great at the farmer's market, like, for instance, Hakurai turnips, those little white globes. They're really fetching to look at, but a lot of people don't know what exactly to do with it. So I'm really excited to be holding a book right now that really, really instructs you in a very novel way how to cook anything, no matter who you are, how big your kitchen is, or where you are. And it's a really great idea. It's called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. And the author of it is on the line right now from California. Her name is Samin Nosrat. Hi, are you there?
Hello, I'm here.
Thank you so much for joining us, Samin.
Oh, and, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed you at the food book fair a couple weekends ago. I know that you're one of the starring names there.
It was like a mayhem. It was a food book mayhem.
I know. Yeah, that's always fun. But I heard you did a great job.
Thanks.
Yeah, and congrats on this book. It's your first book, but it's getting so much attention, and I think really well-deserved. So way to go.
Thank you so much. It really it's very surreal in a lot of ways to to be working on something and want something for so long, and then it happens, and you're like, now what?
Long time in the making, it seems.
Yeah.
So for those who may have heard maybe like sound, like that name sounds a little familiar, Samin Nosrat was featured in the book Cooked by Michael Pollan in 2013. And she was the guru who sort of taught Michael Pollan how to cook in it. And I love those chapters. I really got a sense of who you were, I think, and your infectious laughter, I think you wrote. You're just like really wise, practical cooking skills. It sounded almost like he might have had a little bit of a crush on you.
Oh, wow.
It was just so glowing.
We definitely, you know, it was really what it was. Maybe we both had like intellectual crushes on each other, you know?
Okay, yeah. So he was a professor.
The cool thing, the great thing about Michael is that he got, you know, like I have so many different ways of trying to explain like how we relate to one another. And to me, he is a person who's so in his head. He has this brilliant mind, and I am like 100% heart. And so there were kind of very funny, a lot of very funny misunderstandings, I think.
Oh, wow.
But yeah. What was so beautiful was that, like, because he is so sort of intellectual, like, he was able to pick up on what I was doing and present it back to me in this kind of great way. And so he has been a great help to me. And I think it's funny, too, because I have noticed over the time, like, he's loosened up a lot, like, physically in the kitchen and stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think we rubbed off on each other a little.
That's really cool. So, and in turn, it sounds like, so you were, like, cooking with your heart, and he's, like, furiously scribbling notes, trying to, like, methodically write down whatever the heck you're doing. And then he's inspired you, it sounds like, to work on this method of teaching that you were demonstrating.
Yeah.
So he rubbed off on you in that way to kind of like sort of formalize it a bit more. Is that right?
Absolutely. He definitely, you know, it was really funny. He he picked up on salt, fat, acid, heat. Like, because I was just, it's how I've always talked about cooking since mm-hmm. I sort of came to understand it. It's how I filed away everything that I've learned. And I definitely didn't have a formal language about it, but he picked up on that and that I was talking about. And he asked me, he said, what's the deal? You're so obsessed with these four things. What's the deal? And I said, oh, that's just how I think about cooking. That's how I talk about it. That's how I teach people. Huh. And he said, well, there's your book, you know, because I at that time I was coming to him once a week with, like, a terrible book idea. Like, yeah. every week a new bad idea about a book really? I wanted to write. And every week he'd be like, this is a bad idea. You shouldn't do this. And
really?
So, you know, he was like, it's been sitting in front of you this whole time. Like, why don't you just pursue this? And I just felt like it would be so hard to take these things and put them down on paper. I was really freaked out. I didn't want to do it. And I was really resistant. And I even said to him that first time, I was like, you only want me to do this because it has four parts and all your books have four parts.
That is really funny. That's great. The quattro or the whatever, I don't know, the magic quartet of yeah. chapters. So your whole sort of manifesto is about every good dish has a good balance of salt, fat, acid, and heat, and these are the only elements you kind of really need to know to make anything taste good. Is that, or do you want to go on?
Pretty much it. Okay. Yeah. I mean, to me, I think it. Well, I came upon it at Chez Panisse, where the menu changes every day, and at the time, I was 19 years old. I had not really ever cooked anything before. Really, I mean, I grew up eating great Persian food that my mom was cooking, but I certainly had not spent any time in the kitchen. And so anything that I had made, you know, like I remember I made banana bread as a kid, it was all out of recipes. And then when I really demonstrated this interest at the restaurant, they gave me this long list of books and told me to go home and read. So I would read these cookbooks at night, and, you know, it was like an education in and of itself, you know, Paula Wolford and Marcella Hazan and just like Patience Gray and so much beautiful food writing. But it definitely wasn't helping me get oriented in a kitchen where things were changing every day.
Yeah.
And so I kind of struggled with that for a long time, trying to make sense of what I was reading in the books and then the fact that it wasn't being reflected at work. And I feel like I was treading water for a really long time. I had a headache. I always felt like I was failing and I didn't know what to do. And then eventually I started to see these patterns in the fact that, you know, because no one in the restaurant ever used recipes or cookbooks, and they never even asked really what temperature the oven should be or how long something should
they
cook.
They just knew. Yeah,
everybody knew everything. And so to me it was just, I never, you know, and also like when you're a baby kid in a restaurant kitchen, you're kind of just in the way.
Yeah.
So, and they're not really into you asking a bunch of questions and talking a lot. So you're sort of just learning by observing. So, and that for me came a lot more slowly than if I had been able to, but I probably wouldn't have even known what questions to ask. And so I think it was just a lot of observing over the course of, you know, over a year, that I started to see these patterns of salt, fat, acid, and heat were these four things everyone was paying attention to, and that those were the words that we used when we tasted things, like this needs a little more acid, or is the fat right, or what kind of fat should we use. And I remember I really felt like a genius when I'd figured this out, and I went to the chef and I said, oh, I figured it out, like this is the system, it's how all of the things were cooking, it's salt, fat, acid, heat. And and he just looked at me. He was, like, super unimpressed.
Oh.
And he was like, yeah, we already know that. Like, we all know that. All good cooks know that. And I was like, hello, dude, why didn't you say anything to me? You know, and I felt really betrayed. I was like, if you people already knew this, why didn't someone sit me down a year ago and explain this? And
you know, it
wasn't in any of the books that I had read. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I was like, I want to write this book one day. But I didn't know anything about cooking or writing, so I had to sort of put it in my pocket.
That is so fascinating. And I love the story about how you were just so seduced by a meal that you had at Chez Panisse that you decided to start working there as an intern at first, or as a busser at first, and then an intern, and then for a year in the kitchen. I'm curious, who was the chef who told you, duh? Or
oh, that was actually, it was Chris Lee, who really became my mentor. He was the one who took me under his wing, and later he left Chez Panisse to run another restaurant that I helped him run. And so, but it was just very funny that he was so nonchalant about it, you know? You know? And I also feel really lucky. I feel like so many sort of serendipitous things happened in a row to bring me into that place. And I saved this money with my boyfriend for 7 months to eat there, and we had this magical meal, and the dessert was served to us by this, by who ended up being the floor manager who recognized me and hired me after mm-hmm. I wrote a letter. And then when I started working there, it was, I think I started working there in 2000. And in 2001, the restaurant was named like the best restaurant in the world by Gourmet Magazine. And the chefs really were, at that time, it was just a time in the restaurant's history when so many people had worked there since the beginning or since close to the beginning. So there was just this sort of incredible encyclopedic knowledge in the place. Mm. All the cooks I was working with had been cooking for 10, 15, 20 years. Yeah. And so they were amazing. It was an amazing time. And almost every chef that I worked under at that time has gone on to be like an incredible restaurateur or cook, you know, David Tanis, Cal Peternel,
Russell Moore,
people who went on to open beautiful restaurants. Mm-hmm. So I feel really lucky. Like I just was there at a beautiful moment.
That is really cool. And it's real interesting because you hadn't trained to be a chef. You hadn't thought of taking culinary school or anything like that until you ate a meal there. So it really shows how you're kind of leading your life also with your heart rather than, you know, this methodical approach of like, okay, I take this class and then whatever. So that's really interesting.
It's pretty funny. My friend, one of my friends wrote a little mini profile about me, and mm-hmm. he was like, it's very interesting because your style of cooking and this thing that you're talking about is so loose, you know, and it's all about instinct and the mm-hmm. senses and feeling. But he's like, I suspect that you're a crazy planner. Like, I suspect that you have had this, like, master plan. And and I was like, yeah, it's kind of true. I kind mm-hmm. of am at both ends of the spectrum in this one way where I'm like, let's go with the flow, let's do the thing. But I also am extraordinarily neurotic. I'm highly anxious. Mm. And I have this journal. And I was like, let me show you this journal that I've had for over 10 years where I only write in it a couple times a year, but I sort of write down all my goals and I write down all the stuff I want to do. And only recently did I start going back and looking at it. But it is this amazing thing how even a long, long time ago, I knew very specifically like all the publications I wanted to write for and all of the places I wanted to visit and all the things I wanted to do. So it is kind of a little bit of both. I think it would be disingenuous to say that I'm totally fly by the seat of my pants.
No, of course. Yeah. So what else have you been up to now that you've, cooked in, you know, the best kitchen in the country and you went on to become a chef de cuisine at Chrisley's restaurant in San Francisco, mm-hmm. which is Eccolo, an Italian
Eccolo,
restaurant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Eccolo. What else have you been up to?
So Eccolo closed in 2009. And so for me at that point, you know, I never really had ambitions of having my own place or even really being a chef. It sort of just happened and I went along. And I was still a student at UC Berkeley when I started working at Chez Panisse, and I have always wanted to be a writer.
Okay.
And in fact, right when I was sort of getting into cooking, I applied to graduate school to go study poetry, and I got into this program in New York. And so I went to visit, it was my first trip to New York City, and I went to go visit Sarah Lawrence College. And the weekend that was like the students visiting the campus weekend was the same weekend Chrisley and his family were visiting Italy. And I had asked them to ask this chef, Benedetta Vitali, if she would let me come do an apprenticeship there.
Ooh.
And so the same weekend that I was visiting this program was when I heard back from Chris and he said, yes, like Benedetta said, you can come anytime. And so
just
I had sort of this
college
fork in the road of do I like pursue cooking or do I go to this writing program? And I ended up going to Italy and doing a lot of writing and stuff, but I sort of never abandoned the dream of, you know, writing books and, mm-hmm. and having that. So it always was this thing. I've always pursued the two things, you know, next, like simultaneously. And in 2006 at Eccolo, one day I was looking at the, you know, reservations and seeing who was coming in to the restaurant. And like I did every day just to see if we needed to make sure we're sending something special to people. And I saw Michael Pollan's name. He was reserved. And so that was when I wrote him a letter asking if he would, let me take his class at the School of Journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so he resisted a little bit, but I kept pushing. And so that was how I got to know him, was he let me take this class. And so after like almost 10 years of cooking, or I guess it wasn't 10 years, it was 6 or 7 years of cooking, then I sort of for the first time now stepped into this writing world,
mm-hmm.
which was amazing. And I had these parallel communities. And a lot of the students who are in that class with me with Michael are still, you know, my colleagues. We work in a big writing office in downtown Oakland. And so when Echolo closed, I was ready to not work in restaurants anymore. Uh-huh. And I was like, how do I redefine, you know, what it means to be a professional cook? So I experimented in a few different ways. I opened this thing called Pop-Up General Store, which was sort of like a precursor in some ways to Good Eggs, or like it was this thing where our artisans would come to this marketplace once a month or twice a month, and people could pre-order what they wanted online, and then you could also come and have sort of a farmer's market experience.
Oh, cool.
But it was sort of by mistake that I opened it, and it ended up being super, super popular. And it was too much. Like, I couldn't handle it, and I wasn't really making money, and all these VCs were coming and trying to get me to make that my future. And I realized I didn't want to do that. So I closed that, and I sort of taught other people what I'd learned from that, and then I redoubled my focus on writing.
Mm-hmm.
So every time it's been taking, like, a step away from something else and writing. And so now I mostly write. That's the main, like, way I spend my time. But this book is being turned into a documentary series, so...
A big part
of the next year will be spent doing that.
Oh, that's amazing. Congrats.
Yeah. It is really bananas. It's bananas. Yeah.
All right. So we'll keep tuned into that. That's really exciting. And it's so great that this is sort of like the culmination of all those years of both cooking and writing studies. Samin, let's cut to a quick little commercial break, and we'll be right back to chat more.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
Great.
This is Cynthia, host of Primary Food, here with Anna Bonengel, a registered dietitian with Eat With Zest, eatwithzest.com, and we are here to talk about Bob's Red Mill and superfoods. So, Anna, what is a superfood anyway?
One way to think about it is, if you think of foods along a spectrum, there are a few foods with fewer nutrients, and then there are foods that are packed rich with nutrients and antioxidants. And so superfoods are those that are on the furthest on the scale in terms of having the most nutrients and antioxidants.
Which foods are considered superfoods?
Some are super well known, like blueberries, kale, salmon. But now people are also going nuts over lesser known foods like goji berries, acai, flax, and chia seeds. And a really popular one now is black garlic.
So if I'm trying to eat better, should I go on a strictly superfood diet?
Well, you know, superfoods are, of course, great, and I will say the more you eat, the better. However, eating only superfoods would make you deprived of essential nutrients from nourishing food groups like whole grains.
Okay, got it. Well, that's great, because our sponsor at HRN, Bob's Red Mill, produces a lot of delicious whole grain products.
You know, to be honest, I'm a huge Bob's Red Mill fan. I love a lot of the whole grains that they provide, but I particularly love they've come out with a blueberry hazelnut oatmeal cup. That is totally delicious. It's got classic superfoods like blueberries, but also some of the more trendy ones like flax and chia seeds. It's a really nice mix of trend and tradition.
Bob's Red Mill doesn't chase fads. They just keep working hard to offer as many delicious whole grain and organic food options as possible in an endless commitment to good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
All right, that was a fun little message from our sponsor, Bob's Red Mill. And we're back chatting with Samin Nosrat, the author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking. Thanks so much again for joining us, Samin.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this is such a cool book. Anyone who picks it up will notice that it has really lively, fun illustrations throughout it. In fact, there's even a fold-out page that you can see these, like, Venn diagrams or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and bar charts. Really, really fun produced book. So my question is, okay, salt, fat. I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit.
Okay.
Because I know that you've been teaching salt, fat, acid, heat, like the sort of theories behind this for many years, and you've probably heard a lot of questions, maybe the same ones over and over. But, okay, so what you say
now
that...
I'm like, my blood pressure is rising. I'm like, what's he gonna say?
Well, okay. So, I mean, okay, let's start out simple. Do you consider this to be sort of like a region agnostic approach to cooking? So no matter what cuisine? Okay.
Well, okay. Oh, and now I think I know where you're going. So, okay, let me say, I do think that it's generally, yes, I'm going to say yes, but with caveats, because, of course, different regions, you know, people love to throw Japan at me. I don't know if that's where you were going, as an exception, and a lot, and Korea also, which like really, and they're, you know, I forget what the name of the, there's sort of a triumvirate of things that Japanese cooks are taught. I think it's called washoku.
Oh, that's like a home cooking sort of
It's like
style.
sweet, salty, sour, maybe.
Okay.
And so, and then there's a lot of sugar in Korean food and stuff also. And so there's sometimes people are like, well, you've forgotten, you know, this other important thing. And I don't think, and or as people will say, well, there's no fat in Japanese food, you know. And so what do you know? This, you're completely wrong. Like, it's not universal.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, absolutely, I think I just want to offer this as a way to understand cooking in general, wherever you are. And then, of course, there are going to be exceptions, and of course, there are going to be more things to learn. And so I hope that it just inspires your curiosity to go on. And certainly my curiosity has been, like, absolutely peaked, and I'm really excited to get to travel and eat more things and learn more things. And I would like to maybe find that I was wrong, but I do think that there are some basic things. Some of the things that I've learned along the way are like, fat always behaves in a certain way. You know, we as humans are wired to like the taste of salt, and salt fundamentally does things to food to make it taste better to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we want that. We crave acidity in food to balance flavor. Like, there are just some things that are human nature no matter where you are. And so I do think there are some fundamentally universal things about it. And if this is a great sort of, I don't know, framework for understanding good cooking wherever you are, but there's always more to learn, you know, for all of us. So that's my,
Yeah, no, there's always going to be exceptions, but this is the way to kind of make something taste good, you know, if you're just searching in the dark. And that's extremely useful. I meet so many people who would like to make something great with this piece of fish, and just knowing this kind of like in the back of your head will really, really inspire, I think, a lot of great dishes. But two, I mean, some dishes, though, I'm thinking, don't really have one or two or maybe just one of these things. So what about a classic, what was I going to say? A beef bourguignon.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the acid in that?
Oh, beef bourguignon is full of acid. There's a ton of acid in all that wine, and that wine's really important.
Okay, fine.
And so if that wine's not in there, you know, if you were to make it, say, just with broth, you would really get all of that sweetness from the onions and the carrots, and there would be also, there's a sweetness that comes with the browning, and then there wouldn't be anything to balance it. And so that wine is really, really important there. And there are absolutely dishes that don't have, you know, in fact, I have a friend who was living in Japan after she took the classes, and she was like, you know, I've noticed there just isn't a lot of acidity and stuff. And she would send me like lists of dishes with ingredients that had absolutely nothing acidic.
Okay.
And I was like, you know, you're right. Maybe, and sometimes what I've come to understand is that sometimes it's the way a dish fits into a meal, you know, and sometimes maybe I'm wrong. Like, maybe it's not 100% of the time. Maybe it's just 99% of the time. So, but a lot of the time, the thing about the acids in particular is you don't necessarily, you know, maybe we just only think of acid as like that squeeze of lemon or a few drops of vinegar, but actually anything fermented is acidic, you know, and that includes tea and chocolate
bread
and coffee.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we haven't even attuned our minds to thinking about that. But one of my favorite like examples to use that was mind blowing for me to realize was that caramelized sugar is quite acidic, and it's much more acidic than just a spoonful of white sugar. And so if you caramelize a quarter cup of sugar and then add that caramel into a custard base or an ice cream base, and then make another ice cream base with just a quarter cup of sugar, the caramelized one will taste far less sweet. It will taste so much more balanced, And it'll have all of these other flavors because all of these molecular changes are happening in that sugar that bring all of this other sort of richness of flavor. And so there's a way where there's acid sort of hiding in plain sight a lot of the time. And it's maybe what I'm hoping to do is help you learn how to recognize that so that you have greater agency in making the choices
when you're cooking. I think a lot of people don't realize that they're eating, because, you know, when you think of acidic, you think of like a salad dressing or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm looking at people right now eating pizza at Roberta's. I'm like, oh, it's a sauce, you know, that.
Of course, the tomato sauce,
saying,
and even cheese, too. You know, cheese is, to me, a great, like, cheese and yogurt and any fermented dairy is like a great, that's like back pocket trick, you know, to make anything sort of pop. My family's from Iran, so I grew up eating like a spoonful of yogurt on pretty much everything. I mean, even embarrassingly, as a kid, I just loved putting yogurt on everything. So even when my mom would make like spaghetti with meat sauce, I would put yogurt.
Do you think that your, you know, your Persian heritage and your mom's cooking helps sort of guide your philosophies in cooking today?
Absolutely. It's funny that I didn't really ever, I wouldn't have been able to understand it, I think, until I had this framework, but, and also until I really started to look at Persian cooking systematically and understand it as a culture, like beyond just sort of what my mom was doing. And, there is this sort of beautiful, it's almost like a yin and yang. It's called Sardi and Garmi. That's at the foundation of Persian cooking and at the foundation of...
and well-being,
right? Of making a plate, And so there's so much balancing. It's like a Persian, a perfect ideal plate of food at someone's house, an Iranian person's house, is like a balancing act where there's, you know, the crunchy tadig, the crispy rice from the bottom of the pot, and then the creamy yogurt. And there's like some sweet stew that maybe has plums in it, and then this like pickle or feta cheese. And
lots
so there's
herbs,
always
right?
a little bit of everything to balance everything else, and that's this ideal thing. And so my mom was sort of inoculating me with this sense, you know, without ever explaining it to me and without me understanding it, but I have always sought that balance and that contrast.
It's important.
And that ultimately is at the base of my cooking. That's how I make a salad, you know, and I'm like, oh, I have these, you know, this creamy dressing, so I want to have a really crunchy lettuce or a crunchy, you know, seeds on top or something. And I want to have it, this thing to be rich and fatty, but I also want to make sure it's nice and acidic. And so there is a way where absolutely that has infiltrated my cooking. And also just fundamentally with my, like, exorbitant use of herbs.
Yes.
Persian food is like all herbs, so
that's, I
I'm just adding herbs wherever I go. Yeah,
I think that's really cool, and it really shows how, you know, you understand all these flavors coming in balance and textures too. And I hate to say it, but I wonder if someone, you know, no offense if you did, you know, someone who was raised eating something just really plain, like underseasoned, like a plain hamburger, right, without without the pickles for acidity, without the without salt or something like that, would have grasped this sort of concept as readily.
I like to believe the best, you know, people. And also I have a lot of friends who have kids now, and I spend a lot of time with kids, and different parents have different sort of philosophies of how to get food into their kids' bellies, you know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, and I've realized, like, it kind of doesn't really matter, like, especially because Bea Wilson wrote this book about kids and pickiness. I don't remember what it's called, but it was all about sort of the childhood tendencies of, like, creating palates for children. And so much of what I realized from reading that book was that I think it's up to 18 months is essentially when, well, that's when a kid is really, like, having
receptive.
This explosive experience of the more flavors you can get into their mouth, the more curious eaters they'll be. But then after that, like, all those ages when children are like, I just want ketchup and pasta or whatever, it's fine, you know, it doesn't really matter. Like, that's not the ages. Like, it's more about, to me, cooking and eating is like, let's bring everyone to the table. Let's make everyone sit and talk to each other. Let's have fun together. And that's the height of it. And all of the other stuff can come as long as you're curious and open.
Yeah. no matter, you know, what you're studying too in school.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, it looks like that's about all the time we have, but thank you so much for sharing your wonderful journey with us. And this is a fabulous book.
Oh, so thank congrats. You so much for having me. I hope I get to meet you in person someday.
Yes, please come back to Brooklyn again.
I will. I always do. So.
All right.
I'll track you down.
And best thank of you. Luck. Yeah, with the documentary.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Ooh, I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.